Well, thanks, Juan, and thanks to all the organizers and for the invitation to speak. And right, as Juan said, I'll be talking about quantum scattering amplitudes, post-Minkowski and post-Newtonian, and self-force, and what they can all have to do with each other. And so the context, of course, as usual, is we're trying to solve the binary black hole problem, let's say. Of course, we're also interested in more general problems, like if you have neutron stars and possibly with different kinds of spin and tidal couplings. But in this talk, I'm mostly just going to focus on the binary black hole problem, straightforward in general relativity. And of course, for the most part, for gravitational wave astronomy, we're interested in looking at in-spiraling bound orbits, for which the Virial theorem holds and tells us that the typical velocities in the system squared are of this order of the gravitational potential. So for bound systems, this is a rough equality. And when each of these parameters is much less than the speed of light squared, that brings us to the post-Newtonian approximation, which is the most appropriate weak field perturbation scheme for in-spiraling bound orbits. So first question for this talk is, if we're interested really in gravitational wave astronomy and in-spiraling bound orbits, why are we talking about scattering at all? So a few points. One is, it's kind of an easier problem, or at least it's in some sense cleaner than bound orbits, or there's more clearly available gauge invariant information when you're dealing with basically free particle states at infinity. And furthermore, scattering data, roughly speaking, has also within it information characterizing bound orbit dynamics. So for example, if we restrict attention to the local in time, or that is neglecting tail terms, and we can even add spin in this story if it's aligned spin. So let me in fact add to this picture, let's say a spin pointing out of the plane for this guy, maybe a spin pointing into the plane for that guy. So spins perpendicular to the direction of motion, that's the so-called aligned spin setup, or without spin, but there's been this realization and exploitation in the past several years of the fact that the scattering angle function, so this is in the center of mass frame, again, within the context of conservative dynamics to the extent that that makes sense. In the center of mass frame, both bodies are scattered by the same angle, chi. And that can be expressed as a function of the impact parameter and the relative velocity between the two bodies at infinity. So actually, and of course, it also depends on the masses and perhaps also the aligned spin components. But actually, that scattering angle function, which is a gauge invariant function, fully determines a Hamiltonian function, which then governs equally well both bound and unbound orbits. So demonstrating this point. Okay, so I hope that somewhat motivates why we should be interested in scattering, even if our ultimate goal is the bound problem, not to mention the fact that scattering can take place astrophysically. It may not be particularly relevant for LIGO or LISA, but you never know. Or let me say, I don't know much about that. But okay, a second question. So we already mentioned how the post-Newtonian approximation, where we assume small speeds and weak fields, is most appropriate for bound systems. So why think about the post-Minkowskian approximation, where we assume weak fields, but we try to leave the velocities arbitrary? They could be relativistic velocities. So that's, in a nutshell, the post-Minkowskian approximation applied to two-body dynamics. Why do we care about this? if post-Newtonian is the actually relevant one for bound systems. Well, first of all, it's natural and relevant for scattering to work in the post-Minkowskian approximation. This regime, while inaccessible actually to bound orbits, it is accessible to scattering orbits. So then I point back up here for why are we interested in scattering. It also, the post-Minkowskian approximation complements or partially resums or reorganizes the post-Newtonian approximation. Interestingly, also we can have access to the ultra-relativistic or high energy limit, basically V going all the way to C. And interesting things might happen there, maybe more on that later. And one of my favorite things is let's, in working in the post-Minkowskian approximation, we keep special relativity and its rich structure, Minkowski space, Poincaré invariance, et cetera. We keep all of that intact when we work in the post-Minkowskian approximation. Okay, final hardest question to explain some of the things in the title. Why should we be thinking about quantum when, or should we be thinking about quantum when we want to approach the classical binary black hole problem? And let me just read what I wrote here. We can, and this, so there's a growing program in the last few years underway to exploit powerful computational methods developed for quantum field theories like quantum chromodynamics, QCD, or super Yang-Mills theories or supergravity theories. Just to drop a few names of what are some phrases that go along with these powerful computational methods: generalized unitarity, spinner and twister variables, or spinner helicity variables, as they're sometimes called, and this so-called double copy relation, which in some sense asserts that a gravity theory like general relativity is in some sense at the level of scattering amplitudes, kind of like a square of a Yang-Mills theory like QCD. And associated with these methods are rich structures of on-shell scattering amplitudes in quantum field theories, which, let me just say, they have so far led to new results, which were inaccessible from classical methods, at least that's how it happened historically in the past few years. And nonetheless, depending on how you do this scattered quantum scattering amplitude type calculation, you can carry a lot of baggage with quantum effects, which you don't really want if in the end you're just interested in the classical physics. Nonetheless, it can be in some ways more efficient. And in some sense, maybe when you put back in the quantum parts, you reveal even deeper structure and symmetries that's less clear in the classical picture. Although that's not entirely clear. And maybe a big question in this kind of field is, do these kinds of powerful ideas like generalized unitarity, whatever that means, and spinner and twister variables, probably that has more meaning to most of the audience who are not in amplitudes. Do these have direct classical uses or manifestations? Okay, and so I will admit in the rest of this talk, I'm not going to say much about these powerful quantum scattering amplitudes methods, but Michael Solon is talking later today and he will say a bit about that. So first, let me then briefly, so here, you know, we were mentioning, for example, in the context of conservative dynamics, in the post-Newtonian approximation, this is often usefully described by a Hamiltonian function, which should look familiar to most of us, at least. These two are the Hamiltonian for the Newtonian two-body problem or the Kepler problem. And let me call that N. And then this next column are the first post-Newtonian corrections, going like 1 over c squared, using 1 over the speed of light as a formal expansion parameter. Here, we assume that's much bigger than these guys. And the next column, the second post-Newtonian corrections to the two-body Hamiltonian in general relativity. So this only, this is expressed in a certain gauge, the existence of which is non-trivial and important. It's called isotropic gauge, but it's where it only depends on p squared, the magnitude of the momentum, and 1 over r. And all these other terms are products of p squared and 1 over r. And apart from these rescalings, the momentum, so this is basically the velocity squared, the velocity to the fourth. It depends on the symmetric mass ratio, nu, which I've colored everywhere here in red. And so these are the kinds of results that it has taken decades or to produce. I'm afraid I'm not going to be reviewing much the history of post-Newtonian calculations, except maybe where the current state of the art is. But the game, let's say in post-Minkowskian, is to try to resum each row here, which is a given power of g. So in fact, I've shown here how to resum the first row in this gauge, to recognize really from special relativity the energy of two particles in the center of mass, in their center of mass frame. That resums the top line. So the game post-Minkowskian, the post-Minkowskian approach to the two-body problem is to resum each of these rows. The first one, linear in G, is the first post-Minkowskian level. Quadratic in G, second post-Minkowskian, third, etc. Okay. So here I have a whirlwind tour of developments in, let's say, resumming or approaching post-Minkowskian dynamics to try to resum the post-Newtonian expansion. And so there was a lot of work. So by the way, this is not at all an exhaustive list. These are all just examples that I want to make certain points with. So back in the 80s, lots of people, not just Westphal, were working on the post-Minkowskian approximation directly. And one could say that the crowning achievement, and before this was dropped for a while, was that Westphal in 85 derived from what I'll call brute force classical methods, solving the field equations iteratively away from straight line motion. He found the second post-Minkowskian scattering angle function back in 85, and then post-Minkowskian was dropped in later years in favor of post-Newtonian for the reasons we've already discussed. There was intermittent work, like, for example, Bicek et al. Computed a Hamiltonian valid at first post-Minkowskian order. From the ADM formalism, it was rather complicated, and really, for me at least, the revival of the post-Minkowskian approach to two-body problem, let's say, was heralded by this paper by Thibaut Damour in 2016, where he showed, for example, how that very complicated Hamiltonian that came from the ADM formalism was actually already modulo gauge freedom in the Hamiltonian contained in the standard EOB from Hamiltonian from 1999, which in fact already had the first post-Minkowskian dynamics correct, thanks to just the so-called EOB energy map, and stressing how this information is contained in the scattering angle function, like we mentioned before. He followed up the next year talking about how Westphal's scattering angle function could be used to determine a Hamiltonian valid at 2pm order, so something that resums this line. And in fact, in that paper, he also talked about relations to quantum scattering amplitudes, and in fact called for experts in quantum scattering amplitudes to try to tackle the G cubed level. And that came not long thereafter. Some other important works here, first having an amplitudes derivation to rederive Westphal's 2pm scattering angle. Also going directly to a Hamiltonian from an amplitude at 2pm. And then finally, in January of 2019, Zvi Baron and collaborators came up with using these fancy amplitudes techniques that I just name dropped some of them on the first page. And again, see Michael Solon's talk later today. They computed a conservative Hamiltonian at the third post-Minkowskian order that was just 2.5 years ago. And that was a big breakthrough. And since then, there has been a lot of other work, related work. Not all the references here are necessarily directly using quantum scattering amplitudes methods, but let me say, also inspired by such developments, Gregor Kalin, Raphael Porto, for example, also adapted some of the techniques from this post-Minkowskian amplitudes framework, but really working in a classical post-Minkowskian effective field theory framework, for example, confirmed that third post-Minkowskian result, and also established important relations between gauge invariant observables for bound and unbound orbits that are very interesting, but I'm afraid I won't have time to say anything more about. And again, with D'Amore in the next year, in December 2019, he wrote this very interesting paper actually questioning that 3 p.m. result. And he had in particular questions, I mean, among other concerns, questions about its high energy limit, which in fact, let me just say, is not well behaved by itself. And he proposed various reasons why that might be. In fact, proposed an alternative 3 p.m. result and some other very important things in that paper, which I will come back to shortly. But let me also leave that questions about the high energy limit of the 3 p.m. result. Let me leave that hanging for a moment. Mention quickly some other papers. Kossauer, maybe, and O'Connell had this important framework relating amplitudes to observables. Mogul, Plefka, Steinhoff, and later Jakobsen have developed a related worldline quantum field theory approach, which has been one of the most promising and fruitful approaches to directly produce waveforms from post-Minkowskian calculations. Parmartinez et al. Developing differential equations for doing integrals. Doing integrals is one of the key hard points in this post-Minkowskian amplitudes business. Important work by DiVecchia and collaborators like Russo, Veneziano, and Heisenberg. I think those are the collaborators. Just dropping names, but in the iconal approach, and let me also say, in that paper was the first hint of the importance of radiation in the ultra-relativistic limit, in particular at third post-Minkowskian order, even though, so this is representing multiple papers, but also, and let me just also say, in these two papers, in one and another of these papers, they actually weren't even working on gravity, but were working on N=8 supergravity, at least at first. But this still led to important insights. In particular, this importance of radiation in the ultra-relativistic limit. And then last year, D'Amore came back and answered his own question conclusively, let's say, to say that the reason that the high energy limit of the 3 p.m. result was well behaved was because it was only the conservative part. And when you add to that the radiative part, you get a well behaved high energy or ultra relativistic limit. And in fact, he computed the radiative contribution to the scattering angle from the loss of angular momentum at second post Minkowskian order, which was using an interesting trick. And then let me quickly round this out by mentioning Hermann et al. basically completed the story of the third post-Minkowskian dynamics by computing the radiated energy. And they did this using this KMOC formalism. These two, this radiative contribution of the scattering angle and the radiated energy together, tell you the complete physical change in momentum or impulse of each particle in a scattering. Okay, that took much longer than I expected. But now coming back to something that was actually, let me say, first fairly conclusively demonstrated in this paper by Thibault, is that the scattering angle function has a very particular and surprising, compared to previous understanding, mass dependence. So coming back up to this expression from the Hamiltonian, if we think about taking the mass ratio to zero, so dropping all these red terms, dropping all the red terms, you get geodesics in a Schwarzschild spacetime. This becomes the Hamiltonian for a Schwarzschild geodesics with all the red terms gone. But it looks like, you know, so these are, if you will, first order self-force corrections here at first post-Minkowskian order, and second order self-force corrections, or so it would appear at second post-Newtonian order. And again, this is actually already hiding some things with the true mass dependence with all of these rescalings. But let me say, long story short, Thibault argued that actually from the test body limit, which I'm calling zero SF, due to this particular mass dependence of the scattering angle, you can actually recover the finite mass ratio result up to order G squared. And if you had first order in the mass ratio expansion, 1SF, you would get up to 4PM and so on. And using this mass dependence along with several other ingredients to produce new post-Newtonian or post-Minkowskian results, let's say post-Newtonian, has been called the tutti frutti method, which I will try to explain a bit more. But let's try to understand, at least very briefly, where, in a certain sense, where does this fact, this mass dependence of the scattering angle, where does it come from? And so I don't have time to give a very good argument, but again, I'll refer you to Thibault's paper. These are the first four digits of the archive numbers. See also earlier hints at this structure in these papers and further discussion of it and its generalization to spin in this paper. But let me just say, one can argue, as De Moore did, that the structure of the post-Minkowskian expansion, and a key here is that you're iterating away from straight line motion. The zeroth order post-Minkowskian approximation is your two bodies are just going on straight lines. And then you iterate away from that in the post-Minkowskian expansion using the structure of that expansion of Einstein's equations and equations of motion, effective equations of motion at least, and things like Poincaré symmetry and dimensional analysis. You can arrive at the fact that here I'm saying the magnitude of the change in momentum of each of the bodies in a scattering event in the center of mass frame. So at first without spin. So at first post-Minkowskian order, this is actually a very easy problem. And you find the result has this form where this basically comes from dimensional analysis and the structure of the equations. But there could only possibly be a non-trivial function only of the velocity. And again, you can actually just do this computation quite easily at first post-Minkowskian order. But these arguments, tell you that when you go to the next, so order G squared, and remember there's a G up front here, the expansion of this impulse magnitude function must have this form where when we add an order of G, we add one factor possibly of each mass and then possibly other non-trivial functions only of that relative velocity. And so on. With each extra power of G, an extra power of one of the masses, possibly each with a new function depending only on the velocity. The next step is imposing symmetry under exchange of the bodies. So that, if you think this function, if we exchange the identities of body one and body two, we should not change this function at all. And so first here, that actually tells you that this function of B actually must be exactly the same as that function of B. So there's not actually two free functions there, there's only one free function. And you can see this, these factors of M1 are gonna, and you're gonna get M1 plus M2. That becomes the total mass right there. And here, these two functions must be the same. Tells, again, this comes from the one goes to two symmetry. And similarly, these two and these two. And after a bit of rearrangement and a bit of extra, there's a very simple step in going from the magnitude of the impulse to the scattering angle function that introduces this function of the, this factor of the total energy of the system, which has a non-trivial dependence on the masses. But apart from that, if you basically just take this and relate that to this and simplify, you find at first Post-Minkowskian order, expressed in terms of these variables, the impact parameter, I should have mentioned also, we get an extra factor of the impact parameter for every factor of G times one of the masses. But at the first and second Post-Minkowskian orders, in this form, there is no dependence on the mass ratio. So these guys come from zeroth order self-force in a certain sense. Well, in particular, in this sense, like if we knew, if we take the test body limit here, we lose no information. So we can deduce both of these functions from the scattering angle function for Schwarzschild geodesics. And let me just say, these functions are not complicated. That one is 2 times 1 plus b squared over b squared. And this one is 3 pi times 4 plus v squared over v squared, which is data that you can get from solving the geodesic equation in Schwarzschild. And here we had, in the end, only two free functions of V, and here again, just two. And after these simplifying steps, that tells you that at G cubed order, again, there's a G out front, the result is linear in the mass ratio. And also at G to the fourth, at 4 p.m. order, this scattering angle function is linear in the mass ratio. So it was also argued, in this paper, at least to the linear and in spin level and to the bilinear, the spin one, spin two level, that though this expression is a little bit more complicated after the simplifying steps, going back up to this expression before imposing the one goes to two symmetry, it was argued that the only thing you need to do to generalize this from non-spinning to aligned spins is take each of those Q functions and velocity and promote them to depend also on the ratio of the ring radius or spin per mass of each black hole to the impact parameter. And if you make that substitution,
we have 15 minutes.
Great, thank you. So yeah, that's the proposed, let's say, I don't know, or argued for generalization of this mass dependence of the scattering angle to even include spins, at least when the spins are aligned. And let me make an important point here about this, including spin. So, you know, we really want to think about a real black hole with two finite masses and spins. And in geometric units, these masses, or let's say G times these masses, must be bigger than this ring radius, or else it's a naked singularity. But when we take the test body limit that's appropriate here, so to say that this comes from zero SF, or the test body limit, the first and second orders in the Post-Minkowskian expansion, we have to keep this ring radius or spin per mass, if you will, of the test, what becomes the test body, we have to keep it finite. So it becomes, if you will, a test black hole of finite ring radius and also finite mass rescaled multiple moments for a black hole in a Kerr background with finite mass and spin. And so this is described by the Matheson, Papapetru, Dixon equations, as we've already heard a bit about in this conference, with certain multiple moments for that test body that are supposed to make it a test black hole. So here I have this big table summarizing both post-Minkowskian and post-Newtonian, say, progress in computing higher order terms in both of these perturbative expansions. So let me just mention, for example, the with no spin, the state of the art, as I think most of us are aware for post-Newtonian is the fourth post-Newtonian order for the conservative dynamics. And let me just say, apart from mentioning here that, for example, Blanchet and collaborators, as well as others in other methods, are actively working on completing the radiative part of the 4PN dynamics. But apart from that mention, everything else on the slide is again referring to conservative dynamics, in particular, all these colors in this table, where for no spin, the state of the art is 4PN. And I was going to highlight several. So green means, let's say it's done there. And for me, that means there are at least two groups who agree on the answer with different methods. Blue means it's in progress, which, for example, here, these next to leading order, this next to leading order or 4PN spin squared terms have only been computed by one group, Michel Levy and Jan Steinhoff. Yet by no other method. They were working in this effective field theory approach. So here I'm kind of listing apart. So even just in the post-Newtonian context, let's say there's traditional post-Newtonian calculations which solve the field equations in position space and solve the equations of motion iteratively, etc. This effective field theory is actually also purely classical. This is pioneered by Goldberger and Rothstein, still purely classical, but they use a lot of methods from quantum field theory, like, for example, using Feynman diagram representations of calculations and, importantly, working in momentum space instead of position space. That's a big difference between these two. For example, Fofa et al. And Blumlein et al. Are working towards 5PN. In that context, Michel Levy and collaborators are working toward these 4 and 5 PN spin terms that I just circled there. There are interesting comparisons to be noted about that. I'll mention in a moment. And then I was mentioning this tutti frutti method, that is using this mass dependence of the scattering angle to deduce new post-Newtonian results. So the whole idea of this was pioneered by Bini, Damore, and Giralico, and they have completed the 5PN conservative dynamics modulo the second order self-force terms. And let me now importantly here draw on the boundaries between what are supposed to be. This is actually, I should say, somewhat conjectural, but everything to this side of that line should be, let me say again, this is kind of conjectural, extending when you go to spin especially, and in fact, beyond just a line spins to processing spins. Everything there should be obtainable from the test body limit or zeroth order self force. Everything here should be obtainable in principle from first order self force. And everything here should be second order self force. And there's one box that would need third order self force to complete it. And so we heard earlier in the conference from Muhammad Halil about filling in particular this block and this block and this block using this tutti frutti or mass dependence of the scattering angle to get new post-Newtonian results. And that's one place, for example, if you look at here, sorry, here, and all three of these, actually, there are opportunities for very important comparisons of whether or not this tutti frutti method is actually working with spin and at higher orders in spin in particular. And you'll also notice a lot of this is coming with the caveat that it's restricted to aligned spins again. And I should really press forward. So I'm going to skip this discussion of post-Minkowskian and talk about quickly. So these post-Newtonian tutti frutti calculations, they require the assumption the existence of a Hamiltonian. Skip that next point. The mass dependence of the scattering data, as we were just talking about, that's important. And very importantly, the inputs from self-force in these methods are analytic PN expansions of bound orbit self-force gauge invariant quantities, like the redshift and the precession frequency, spin precession frequency, and tidal invariance. For example, there have been a lot of calculations by Beanie and collaborators and Chris Kavanaugh and collaborators computing those kinds of things. Both of them have also involved in these, using these things to produce methods. We heard from Muhammad Halil's talk on Tuesday that we would be able to complete the aligned spin 5PN S squared if we had a first order self force result, which is not available. That is the first order self force spin precession frequency in Schwarzschild with linear end spin on the little guy. And then very interestingly, during Mohammed's talk, I'm afraid I forgot the name, Josh Matthews spoke up and said, I think we have that. So I'm interested to hear about that later today. Another important ingredient in these calculations is the first law of binary mechanics as developed by Alex Lutyak and collaborators. And let me make this the last point, that all of these, or at least these last three ingredients here, are roughly understood, again, for this aligned spin situation. And all of them need important generalizations to precessing spins. For example, to compute not just the aligned part of the 5PN spin squared, but all of it. So in particular, there are so far no versions of the first law with spin precession. I should change that. There is actually, again, from Lutyak and collaborators, with a test body, a small body with no spin and a curve background, there is a version of the first law. But let's say for both bodies spinning and with the spins not aligned, there are important points to generalize the first law and also the ingredients in the first law, like these analytic PN expansions of bound orbit, even self-force gauge invariance. what are those quantities even for precessing orbits? And so as there's only now 4 minutes for questions, instead of continuing, I think I should stop and leave that 4 minute for question, 4 minutes for questions. And thanks very much for listening.
Thank you, Justin, for a very nice talk. We do have several questions already. So, Kuno, I'll mute you.
Yeah, thank you so much. I just had a quick question. Earlier in the slides, you were showing how you're using the mass symmetry. Could we go back to that slide for just 1 second?
Yeah.
So I understand why you're trying to claim that the masses have to be symmetric, and the deflection angle for one has to be dependent on the mass of the other. And then if you do a mass symmetry, the deflection angle of the other one has to be dependent on the other mass. I'm going to talk about this a little bit later in my talk, but why do you assume that the deflection angles of the two particles are necessarily the same?
That's a good question. So again, it's in the center of mass, or let's say the center of momentum frame.
Yeah.
So by definition, the incoming momenta here and here, let's say,
yeah,
are equal and opposite, mm-hmm, by definition of the center of momentum frame. And if, yes, it's a conservative situation,
yeah,
the outgoing momentum will also be equal and opposite.
So I agree with that. How do you assume that it's a conservative reaction, though?
Okay, so this is an assumption. So
okay,
to the extent, and it's a good assumption, to a rather high order, to the extent, okay, you can cleanly separate conservative and dissipative dynamics.
Okay.
Yeah, it is really an assumption, let's say, for generally, but it is a good assumption to very relatively high orders.
That, okay,
which you can clearly separate conservative from dissipative. Good question.
Okay, thank you. Mm-hmm.
Okay, we have time for one quick question, maybe. Chris, you had your hand raised. Do you still have? Oh, Ricardo. Let me unmute you.
Okay, just. He says, "Can you hear me?"
Yes.
Okay, quickly. So the deflecting angle then seems to be more fundamental than the Hamiltonian. But you see, the 1pn Hamiltonian has the symmetric mass ratio in it. So does it mean that the 1pn Hamiltonian, 1pm Hamiltonian requires higher order in the deflection angle? You see?
Right. So, yeah. So like you're talking about, like, for example, here at 1pn, there is,
yes, new. Yeah. I have the symmetric mass ratio dependence, which is not up to 3pm in the, yeah, deflecting angle.
And let me just say, it really is, these really are first order self-force corrections. If you think about a straightforward expansion in the mass ratio, these really are self-force corrections, and they are there. In fact, as I alluded to earlier, there are even mass ratio corrections at Newtonian order, but I've kind of hidden them away with all these rescalings or, yeah. But let's just say there are corrections in the mass ratio. In fact, if you think about it properly, at all orders in the mass ratio, at every post-Newtonian order. But even with this rescaled way, yeah, they're here. So those are self-force, first order self-force corrections, let's say. But yeah, in a sense, like, the Hamiltonian makes it harder to see that there is a way of taking a test body limit where you lose no information at first post-Newtonian or at second post-Minkowskian. And that is most clearly visible in, you're right, like you said, the scattering angle function. In this reorganization of variables, here you see that when you take the test body limit, you lose no information at these levels.